at the Universidad de Oriente in Puerto Cruz, Venezuela. So he is an American expert to Venezuela. He's been there for a long time. And for a 10-year period, taught in the Graduate School of Law and Political Science of the Universidad Central de Venezuela. He has also been a visiting professor at Georgetown University, Duke, Universidad de los Andes, Universidad de Buenos Aires, the Australian National University. Among his book publications are Venezuela's Movimiento al Socialismo, From Guerrilla Defeat to Electoral Politics, Organized Labor in Venezuela, Behavior and Concerns in a Democratic Setting, Rethinking Venezuelan Politics. The list goes on and on, and it's rather long, so I won't list it. I won't read it. He has also published on the op-ed pages of the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, as well as The Nation, and is a regular commitment to NACLA, Report on the Americas. I should also say that Steve is broadly recognized as an expert on Venezuela. We've had the good fortune of having him here in previous events that we've organized. He has been a contributor to multiple edited volumes, including one or two that were put together here at Tulane. So it is a distinct honor for us to have him at CIPR this semester, and a great pleasure to give the floor over to you, Steve.
Thank you, Ludovico.
Steve's going to present for about half an hour, and then we're going to open it up for questions.
Okay, I will begin by placing Venezuelan developments in a broader context, namely the rise of the Latin American left and center-left governments in the 21st century, which I consider to be a very interesting and significant development, and also a unique development. If you compare this leftist wave of the last 15 or so years, more than 15 years, to previous waves of democratic, populist, leftist, center-leftist governments in the past, for instance, Huntington's second wave in the post-World War II period, which was much shorter in duration, in the case of Venezuela, from 45 to 48, Peru also, the government supported by APRA, the Bustamante government, fell in 48. And other waves, such as the wave that began in Venezuela in Colombia in the late 50s, Colombia in 57, Venezuela in 58, and then the Kennedy period of the early 60s, that was even shorter. But not only the duration, but also the fact that those previous waves didn't have the cohesion, didn't have the solidarity that is characteristic of the 21st century left and center left. Take the case of Guatemala in 54, how the United States was able to isolate Guatemala at the OAS meeting in Caracas in 1954, gives an idea of the lack of cohesion, the lack of unity of these movements in the past. Various writers have presented different interpretations with regard to the rise of the 21st century left and center-left governments. Eduardo Silva, who isn't here, you notice, attributes that phenomenon to neoliberalism and the reaction to neoliberal governments, beginning with Pinochet in the 80s and then the other neoliberal governments for the most part in the 1990s. Now that these leftist and center-leftist governments are on the defensive, perhaps will not survive politically during the next year or two, as in the case of Venezuela, with elections coming up, national congressional elections coming up in December for the National Assembly, in the case of Brazil, in the case of Argentina, with elections that are coming up this weekend, Scioli, the candidate for the Cristina Kirchner, will probably win those elections, but may swing the pendulum in a rightist direction. So that it seems to me that it's equally important to analyze why this is happening, just like it was important to analyze why these governments came to power in the first place, why this leftist wave, now it's important to analyze why it may be going out of business. And it seems to me that it's important to go beyond the economistic explanation of commodity prices to explain the wave in the first place. Some say, well, it's all about the increase in oil prices. That's why Chavez was radicalized or was able to present more radical positions and policies. It was all about the price of oil. And in the case of Bolivia, something similar. In the case of Ecuador, something similar. It's important to go beyond that economistic, simplistic explanation. And in the same sense, it's important to go beyond that explanation with regard to the difficulties that these governments are facing, both political difficulties and economic difficulties. To say that Morales lost these last two elections in Bolivia because, well, the price of hydrocarbon and the price of soybeans have declined, and therefore he's having economic difficulties. One explanation for these economic, social, and political difficulties is that there is the neoliberal policy, that the policies that these governments adopted were just flawed to begin with. In other words, in a sense, and now I'll talk specifically about Venezuela, Maduro shouldn't be blamed, because it was the policies that that Chavez adopted in the early years of his government that explains the economic and now social and political problems that the country is facing. That this really goes back to not Chavez's election in the Constitutional Assembly of 1999, but rather the economic policies that were adopted between 2003 and 2008. 2003, when price controls were established, when exchange controls were established, and then with the nationalizations of 2007 and 2008 of electricity, of the telecommunications sector, cement, steel, and what the Chavistas call the nationalization of the oil industry, which was really a partial nationalization. But in any case, those policies represented a kind of original sin that explains the problems that the country is facing today. In other words, the chickens have come home to roost. And I think it's important to analyze that explanation, because that explanation has very important implications with regard to economic policy in general, with regard to models. Because after all, these policies that were allegedly flawed were not socialism. Exchange controls are not socialistic. And these other policies that I mentioned are not socialistic, but rather represent the old import substitution model of state intervention in the economy. And what's being questioned is really state intervention in the economy. After all, the exchange controls that were established in 2003, in early February 2003, the Herrera Campins Christian Democratic government, social Christian government, established exchange controls for the first time in 1983. And the price controls that were also established in 2003 go back at least to the 1970s, to the first administration of Carlos Contreras Perez, who was somewhat of a nationalist, economic nationalist, in his first government. And the nationalizations, after all, this was a banner of AD, Acción Democrática, going back to its founding and actually its precursor party, the PDN. And it was incorporated in the Constitution of 1961, ratified by COPEI, by Acción Democrática, by the leftists who were in Congress, and ratified that. So that it seems to me that that really has important implications that are worthy of serious analysis. Kurt Weiland argues that populist policies are inherently unsustainable, at least on the social front. That populist governments are quicker to establish populist, social programs than are non-populist governments. But in the case of the populist governments, those programs are unsustainable. So that part of the debate really revolves around populism. And that became a big issue of debate with the book Leftovers that Jorge Castaneda co-edited. His article in Foreign Affairs and other articles of his, in which he talked about a good left and a bad left. And that dichotomy between the good left and the bad left was seriously questioned by a number of writers, Stephen Levitsky and Kenneth Roberts. Their book and the book by Cameron and Hirschberg and Beasley, which Santiago has a chapter in. Here he is. On the basis of the fact that the left is more diversified, the hard left is more diversified, or the radical left is more diversified, and the moderate left is also more diversified, to throw those into sacks. To say that these are two neat categories that can be established and discussed. In my book on Latin America's radical left, I accept that dichotomy. Basically, I say, all right, there is a moderate left, and I agree that it does make sense to talk about a moderate left and a radical left. But that, as the title of my book implies, Latin America's radical left, challenges and complexities of political power in the 21st century, the key word in all those words is complexity. That the challenges that the radical left faces are complex. And if they're complex, then it doesn't make sense to just talk about a bad left and to simplify the phenomenon of populism and to say it's all about a caudillo, a power hungry caudillo, and an ignorant mass. I would like to also accept the premises of the people who write on populism to explain the difficulties that the radical left, and specifically the Chavista government, is facing in Venezuela. In other words, I accept the fact that there was, I wouldn't call it an original sin, but there were policies adopted during that period from 2003 to 2008 that have led to the predicament of the Chavista government today. So that I'm really, again, using this idea of complexity to explain a phenomenon and criticizing the critique that is based on this simplified notion that there were policies that were not sustainable, that were adopted. It took some time for that to play out, but now we have a crisis situation due to those policies. So that I think the term complexity is key. Before I explain why I believe it's key, I skipped over a point. These are my notes. In Spanish, they're called chuletas. In Venezuela, they call them chuletas, which means that professors can use them, students can't, on exams. But I skipped over an important point, and that is that I accept the definition, I accept the use of the concept of populism to explain the phenomenon of the 21st century left, but I don't adhere to the pejorative definition that Kurt Whelan uses and Castaneda certainly uses, that goes back to Gino Germani's pejorative concept of populism, is what I just mentioned before, a caudillo leader and an ignorant mass. I'm not saying that Kurt accepts that definition at all, but I think Castaneda does, and that goes back to Gino Germani Germani's writings about the Peronist movement, the Peronista movement of the 1950s. And I use another school of thinking about populism, specifically Ernesto Laclau's concept of populism, which basically says that in the era of globalization, although he doesn't use the term globalization, I don't think, but he does use the term postmodern, or he's part of the postmodern trend, postmodern modernist thinking, namely that in the modern period, in other words, the industrial period, the old period, you had strong unions. And those strong unions and the working class that was behind the union movement represented different popular sectors of the population. So it was a simple kind of situation. The working class representing the popular sectors in general, and the bourgeoisie, if you want to use that term. In the postmodern period, I'll say in the period of global capitalism, the union movement has been weakened, and the popular movements are much more fragmented. The social movements are much more fragmented. So you have a more complex situation. And that's the term that I use, that I apply to the case of Venezuela, and it's applied to other countries in my book on the Latin American left. So today I would like to talk about the complexities that explain the dilemma that the Maduro administration is facing, and say that those policies that were adopted that led to the problems of today have to be contextualized. And that is my sort of contribution to this discussion. Trying to contextualize, trying to understand why these policies were adopted given the situation, the political situation in the country between 2003 and 2008. And I think the point of departure is the opposition. The opposition, which I label a disloyal opposition, using the term that Juan Linz popularized. And basically, you know, all politicians in power face oppositions, and oppositions are hard-hitting, by definition. That's what politics is all about. After all, if you're not after power, then don't, you know, get involved in politics. And if power is the name of the game, then you're going to hit hard. So it's not a question of an opposition that is hard-hitting or even aggressive, but rather three characteristics. One is an insurgent opposition, an opposition that attempts to overthrow the government through a coup d'etat, through the use of force or the threat of the use of force, or as in the case of the general strike, paralyzing the economy. In other words, a material situation which the economy is threatened, or the people who are in power are threatened. So that's one characteristic. And then the other characteristic, which has two aspects, is the refusal to recognize the legitimacy of the government. Firstly, because the government is committing electoral fraud, and secondly, because the government adopts policies that are so beyond the ken, that creates so much damage to the country, that government has to be replaced, and we can't wait until the upcoming elections. They have to be replaced immediately. There's no common ground. There's no area of agreement. And in the case of the Venezuelan opposition, all three of these categories are applicable. The attempted overthrow of the government with the coup in 2002, with the general strike in December 2002, January 2003, and the use of force, the guarimba, which is a term in Venezuela, I think it's an indigenous term, but it refers to street violence that was carried out following the general strike, when the opposition said, we can't wait even until the recall election, because that's going to be in 2004. And by 2004, Venezuela is going to be a dictatorship. The government is going to establish a dictatorship. So we can't even wait until 2004. We've got to overthrow the government now. And then the same Guarimba was carried out in 2014, last year, for a period of 3 or 4 months. So that's another, that's one aspect. And the other aspect is the accusation of electoral fraud, which was the case with the recall election. The opposition immediately announced that there was electoral fraud, and that happened when Maduro was elected. And the CNE, the Consejo Nacional Electoral, has always been questioned by the opposition, and they're doing that now in the elections that are coming up in December. And then the third item, the lack of a common ground, the accusation that the government is causing great harm and hasn't done any good. It is true that the opposition is accepting the social programs. Capriles, at least in his electoral offer, stated that the social programs of the Chavistas are basically good, but we have to go beyond that and overcome the downsides. So that is true. But there hasn't been a common ground, and there hasn't been the possibility that the Chavistas and the opposition will sit down and iron out difficulties. At least in 2004, during the period of the Guarimba violence, the opposition refused to accept, for the most part, they refused to accept what was called, Maduro called the Diálogo de Paz, the peace dialogue. So I argue that this context helps us understand two sets of policies that the government carried out that, in a sense, if you want to use this term, did represent an original sin. I'd rather not use that term, but to say that it did create problems further down the road. One set of problems, what I call, and perhaps for lack of a better term, but the term that I'm using now, is expedient pragmatism, in which the government, in the context of the threats of overthrow the government through a general strike, through a coup, etc., and specifically in the context of the general strike, the government allied itself, not explicitly, but allied itself with those business people who did not support the general strike. That was in December of 2002, January 2003. There were a group of business people, smaller business people, many of Arab descent, who for three different reasons, either they were sympathetic to Chavismo, or they believed that business people shouldn't get involved in politics and certainly shouldn't try to overthrow governments, or because they were opportunists. But the Chavistas, and Chavez in particular, who was a realist, was a pragmatist, although many people don't realize that on the left and the right. He was pragmatic. And he decided that he would provide these business people, even the opportunists, although nobody was making the distinction between who was the opportunist and who was the Chavista. They all were supposedly supporting the government. But even in the case of an opportunist who didn't support the general strike, the possibility that another general strike, another conflict could present itself, and those opportunists would not support that insurgent effort, led Chavez to provide them with a preferential treatment, specifically with contracts, with preferential dollars. I won't go into that unless somebody during the question and answer period wants me to elaborate on that. But the preferential dollars means that importers receive dollars at an artificially low exchange rate in order to purchase goods from abroad. And Chavez announced that those people who supported the strike, the golpistas, would not receive preferential dollars. So this was an alliance. It was perhaps an informal alliance. And I argue that politically it was successful. To have a group of business people who supported the government, who sat down when the government called on business to negotiate, when the government called for business people to attend, you know, assemblies and made presentations to them. It was very convenient to have these business people attend the conferences during the Guarimba period. They sat down and they played a leadership role in supporting the Diálogo de Paz of Maduro. So politically, it was fairly successful, but economically, it wasn't. And the proof of that is that with the crisis situation today, with the shortages, that emerging business class has not been able to fill the gap. That was the intention, that was the strategy, and it hasn't panned out. So that I would say that not only was it not economically successful, but the problems of corruption in the government that I don't think anybody denies has something to do with that privileged position that these business people received from the government. In 2009, there was an economic crisis. There was a banking crisis. And the government expropriated a number of banks. And one of the members, the biggest member of this business group, Ricardo Fernandez Parrueco, who, according to some accounts, was a billionaire as a result of contracts that he got from the government to supply food to the government food distribution agency called Mercado, he purchased three or four of these banks, and all those banks went under, and Chavez jailed him. He was in jail for 3 years, and other pro-Chavista business people, including the brother of Jesse Chacon, one of Chavez's right-hand men, was thrown in jail also for 3 years. So that, obviously, there's a cause and effect relationship here between the privileged position of these business people and the economic problems. And I believe that also the corruption that followed as a result of the granting of preferential dollars by Cadivi, which was the government agency that granted preferential dollars, and one of the ministers, Jorge Giordani, stated that the government was built of $20 billion as a result of bogus companies that applied for dollars and then brought into the country empty ships or empty containers. I believe that that scandal involving $20 billion, and I won't get into that because it really is somewhat of a side point, but I believe that that scandal was more complex. I believe that it involves, and there's studies that indicate that there were a number of business people were involved in that, pro-Chavez business people, anti-Chavez business people, and multinational corporations. Of course, the government is to blame. They're the ones that are administering these preferential dollars. But in any case, there is a cause and effect relationship between the preferential treatment that the government gave to this business group and the emergence of business people who were corrupt and took full advantage of those privileges that they received. The other aspect of this pragmatism is that when it became evident that the emerging business sector was not going to produce in order to fill these gaps or in order to promote economic development or overcome the shortages, the government decided to sit down with FEDECOMERCE, with the Chamber of Commerce that had spearheaded the coup in 2002 and the general strike in 2002 and 2003. In 2014, FEDECOMERCE sat down with the government and negotiated. Now, that was a success for the government. The fact that at a time when the opposition politicians refused to negotiate with the government in order to overcome the violence of those 3 or 4 months, that the business sector, which was the main actor, the most important actor in 2002-2003, more important than the politicians of the opposition, more important than the trade union leaders that called the general strike, and more important than other actors, they were willing at this point to sit down and negotiate with the government. But when you negotiate, you have to be willing to accept concessions. That's what negotiations are all about. Otherwise, sitting down at the negotiating table doesn't have any meaning. And there was a cause and effect relationship between a number of policies that were adopted, even though the government never stated, and Fede Commodus never stated, that these policies were a result of those negotiations. But just to give one example, Fede Commodus insisted that those people, those business people who were accused of contraband, which is massive in Venezuela, as I'm sure most of you know, price speculation, which is another way of saying inflation, which is also very steep in Venezuela, that in the hoarding of goods, which was also very prevalent, that those people who were accused should be given a fair trial, and before the trial is finished, the government shouldn't politicize those cases. That was Fede Commodus' position. Fede Commodus stated, okay, if these people are guilty, they should pay the consequences. But before that has been proven, the government should not politicize the case. Up until then, the government had been announcing, every time they confiscated a semi that was on its way to Colombia, was near the Colombian border, there were photos that were taken, the trucks were confiscated, the drivers were thrown in jail. Then that ceased happening. And the government efforts to combat the so-called economic war became more low-key. So it seems to me that that is an example of one of these cause and effect relationships of the political situation, the violence in 2014, pressuring the government to come to terms with the business sector, and that resulting in a certain modification of policies. Now, because of the time factor, you said 40 minutes was the maximum, so I've got 10 more minutes. Let me just go to the second set of policies, and that's what I call unsustainable populism, to use a term that Kurt Whelan uses. And I do believe that there were, or there are, unsustainable populist policies, but my argument against those scholars who support the resource curse thesis that third world countries, when prices go up of their exports, there's prosperity, but then when prices go down, there's nothing to show for it. And I argue that it's not that simple, because the social policies have to be disaggregated. And some of those social policies result in learning, such as the education missions that the government, these makeshift programs, which I've taught in at the university level, it's called Mission Sucre, and the high school level was called Mission Ribas. So empowerment is one objective, and that's a legitimate objective. And also, learning. And the other legitimate objective is empowerment. And the community council program, in which community councils receive funding in order to carry out public works projects, is a tremendously interesting experience for people, especially members of the marginalized sectors of the population, who don't have any organizational experience, who don't have experience with unions, as workers do. They belong to the informal economy. But the opportunity to design projects, to apply for funding from the government, and in some cases to carry out the projects themselves rather than through companies that receive the contract, that provides a sense of empowerment, and that's legitimate. So that's one objection to this all-encompassing view, that it's really all about increasing productive capacity. If a government doesn't do that, then it's not doing anything, because in the long run, when commodity prices decline, then the government will have, the country will have nothing to show for all that money that came into the country. I argue that the social programs are important. But another point that I want to make, in the way of refuting the Castaneda concept of cheap populism or crass populism, is that these programs have generated debate within the Chavista movement. That some of the Chavistas, and I would argue, and I do that in my book, that the Chavistas who tend to come from the middle class and the working class favor an emphasis on economic targets, economic goals, and that the social goals are considered subservient to the economic ones. Those who belong to the marginalized sectors of the population that represents the social base, represent the social base of the Chavista movement and the Chavista government, they favor emphasizing social programs. And the fact that you have a debate going on, albeit informal to a certain extent, demonstrates another fallacy of the Castaneda thesis, because if a debate's going on, then the idea that those followers of the Caudillo is an ignorant mass that is attracted to the Caudillo because of his personality, because of his style, which gets heavily emphasized in some of the literature, even the literature on the other side of the spectrum, the Chavista literature that emphasizes style over content. I would argue that the fact that a debate is going on indicates that it's not that simple, that it's not all about a Caudillo. There are issues involved, and those issues are getting discussed. And the last point I want to make with regard to the social programs is that the fact that those social programs have been politically successful, the fact that Rosales, who was a candidate in 2008, began a new policy on the part of the opposition to accept the validity of the social programs and say the social programs have been beneficial. Up until then, the opposition was much more critical of the social programs. And Capriles, as I mentioned before, said the same thing when he ran for president on both occasions. The fact that these programs are politically successful, I think would indicate also that there are issues involved, that issues are getting discussed. And that goes counter to this prototype of a Caudillo who attracts the masses on the basis of his charismatic qualities. So just to sum up, I do not mean to state that there is a path dependency phenomenon in which the government adopts these policies, the strategy is derailed, and the new strategy is, there are so many flaws that it's doomed to failure. Because there's a certain logic here. If the strength of the opposition, if the threat of the opposition explains the government's decision to modify its programs, to adopt these pragmatic policies, to adopt these populist policies, if it's all about political factors, then at a moment in which the opposition is weak, that's the moment for the people in power to overcome these shortcomings. And I would refer to three different targets here. One would be lashing out at the opposition. If the opposition is weak, then at that moment the government has the political movement has the opportunity to weaken the opposition further. Second, to deepen the process of change. And I think Chavez did both of those. Just to give you an example, after he won the presidential elections in 2006 by a landslide, he did not renew the concessions of Radio Caracas, an important TV channel. Now, I'm not getting into whether that was good or bad, whether that was justified or not justified, but the fact is that he took advantage of that particular moment to weaken the opposition, and he was successful in that sense. So I would say that there were specific moments during these 16, 17 years that the Chavistas have been in power in which the Chavistas were in an ideal situation, a critical juncture, if you want to use that term. When Chavez won the recall election, in 2004, when Chavez was elected president by 63% of the vote in 2006. And I would argue that Chavez took advantage of those situations to a certain extent. But I'm also critical, because I think that he could have done more to achieve a third objective, which I didn't mention. And that third objective is to control the bureaucracy, to try to rein in the bureaucracy, and the struggle against corruption, the fight against corruption. That third objective, which becomes feasible in these critical junctions, when the radicals in power have the upper hand, Chavez gets mixed rating when it comes to that. But Maduro gets very low, gets a very low score. Maduro hasn't taken advantage of those windows of opportunity. When the Chavistas won the municipal elections in December of 2013, they won by 11.5%. The opposition, led by Capriles, called those elections a plebiscite. In other words, Capriles said the opposition is going to win, and that means, even though they're municipal elections, he said this is going to allow us to, overthrow bring about a regime change. This will be the first step. But to his disappointment, the Chavistas won by 11.5 percentage points. So that was an ideal moment to strike out and achieve those three objectives, which he didn't. He didn't do. And the second ideal opportunity, a missed opportunity, was when the Guarimba, when the violence of early 2014 petered out. At that point, in May of 2014, Maduro could have acted. So I would say that all people who study history, who study about revolutions, who study about structural change, radical change, know that in no situation historically have the, let's call them revolutionaries, have the revolutionaries been able to carry out their policies and design their policies without a hardened opposition, beginning with the French Revolution. And that opposition has always been at times violent, has been propagandistic, etc. That was the case with the Soviet Revolution, it was the case with the Cuban Revolution, with the invasion of Cuban in April of 1961, and was the case with the Chavista government. But there's a second factor. In addition to this material opposition of violence, there's a second factor, and that is the opposition has very often forced the revolutionaries, or forced the radicals, to derail their strategy and to adopt policies that are expedients, but in the long run cause great harm to their stay in power. And I think that that is really worthy of study. It was the case with the French Revolution, when that opposition created a kind of paranoia and led to the Reign of Terror of Robespierre. And I would tentatively say, and I'm not an expert on this, I know very little about it, and it's not my area of expertise and concern, but there's a recent book by David Laidman, the editor of Science and Society, who argues this, that Stalinism was a result of the Nazi threat, the Nazi invasion, and even before that, the Civil War of 1918. So Stalinism emerges in that context. And even though Stalin was denounced by Khrushchev in 1956, nevertheless, and this is the point that Laidman makes, the Stalin legacy very much limited options and created difficulties all along for the remaining, you know, 4 or 5 decades of communist rule in the Soviet Union, 3 or 4 decades in the Soviet Union. Whether that is true, that's a different story. But with regard to Venezuela, I would argue that that is the case. That the problems that the country is facing today is due to a number of factors. Certainly the decline in the price of oil is an important factor, I don't deny that. But that I think in order to understand the difficulties that the government is facing, that the policies that were adopted during that period of 2003 to 2008 have to be placed in a broader context. Thank you.
I'll let you field your own questions.
Okay. Yeah.
Let me go first, because my iPad is about to turn off.
Okay.
I totally agree with the intention. I think the whole idea that there's something inherently unsustainable about populism or social spending and we need to pause, I think, is false, and I think it's good to push back on that. I also agree with the idea of looking at the opposition and looking at especially the opposition that happened between 2000 and 2004 as a key sort of conjuncture for understanding the history of Chavismo. But I think of it in a little bit different way. I mean, I see it as a period in which that's what pushed Chavez to 21st century socialism instead of what was participatory democracy was the key metaphor before that. And so that gives, I think, a different interpretation to a lot of what you say here. You know, this idea of pragmatism to be allied with business people that didn't support the strike, I think they created those business people. A lot of these people had no business experience at all, and they were people that were willing to fill a role, and they made huge profits on this, you know, preferential dollars and preferential markets. The government, it wasn't just in business. If you look at the same time that they did this in business, they did this in participation too. They sponsored participation, all kinds of alternative NGOs and social movements. They came up with the missions, all these parallel forms of governance and social policy. They came up with a whole parallel higher education system. The whole idea was of revolutionizing, getting rid of it, or if you can't get rid of the bourgeois state, circumventing it with this whole bourgeois society with a new society. And so, you know, if you look at it more broadly that way, and then you also look at the fact that after by 2005, the opposition was largely vanquished for many years, until 2008 at least. But the government went on consolidating that, so it wasn't just a response to the opposition; the opposition withered away. But to me, it was they had come up with a new metaphor. They had come up with this metaphor of socialism, and it was a Leninist type of socialism, and you tried to create this parallel society, these parallel institutions. And the results of this, I think, were somewhat predictable. That there was ossification, there was corruption. In the end, the economy didn't work, the state hasn't worked, participation has largely been co-opted. And that's because of a certain view, or a certain governing vision that they have, creating this parallel state, you know, on the romantic idea of unity. You know, that we all have to be on the same page, and you're either with Chavez or against Chavez. No, and so that I think almost by definition leads to a sort of ossification. And so, you know, I think that gives it something of a different. I think it was inherent flaws. It's not inherent flaws in populism. It's inherent flaws of socialism. I think. And I don't think that it wasn't because they couldn't implement their plan. I think they had a huge, almost carte blanche to implement their plan. And I think the thing is the plan was just flawed.
Okay. You know, if I show you my chuleta here, you'll see that I think I've got here someplace. That the point you're making is a point I was going to touch upon, and that is that these pragmatic and populist policies are adopted at the same time. There's a reverse tendency, and they both take place. There is radicalization. There's no question about it. And the defeat of the opposition, Chavez's acumen, is due to the fact that he knew when to deepen the process and when to carry out additional policies that you refer to. So I agree with you, but I would argue that both things are going on at the same time, that there's a radicalization, but at the same time there are concessions. And that's not seen by scholars because there is such polarization, and because the Manichaean discourse of Chavez and the Chavistas, it's hard to believe that concessions are taking place. And in addition to that, Chavez comes to power railing against the Pacto de Punto Fijo, the Pact of Democracy. So everything would lead one to believe that, no, Chavez is not reaching agreements with the business sector. But that took place. And I would argue, with regard to the missions, the fact of the matter is that the missions were successful. and did represent a deepening of the process of change, but at the same time, the two things are going on at the same time, there were unsustainable aspects of those social programs. And that's why I say that the whole process has to be disaggregated, because there's a continuum that goes from empowerment and learning experiences on the one hand to unsustainable policies on the other. And just to give one example, David, the cooperative movement, the government established a special fund in some Chavista states, at least, so that a person that wanted money, who applied for money in order to establish a workers' cooperative, and had to put up a fianza,
a bond.
Okay, you think quicker in English than I do. The government would provide that. Well, that defeats the whole purpose of the bond. Why have a bond in the first place? And, you know, a vast number of those cooperatives failed. So that's just one example of, you know, an example of an unsustainable aspect of a program that was not necessarily unsustainable and that had positive features, but nevertheless had aspects in terms of its implementation that you could say were unsustainable. And with regard to the other point that you make, that Chavez, you know, had this period in which he was firmly in control and didn't have to worry about anything, I would argue that these policies create certain expectations. And once the expectations are created, it's very hard at any moment to undo them. And I'll just give you one example that has to do with the middle class, largely. And that is the program of preferential dollars to travel abroad. Now it's reduced, but nevertheless, it's practically a giveaway. You travel to another country, it depends on where you travel to, you purchase dollars. At now, with the unofficial exchange rate, you know, 40 times higher than the official exchange rate, you're practically not paying anything for those dollars. Now, that created expectations among the middle class, and it would be very difficult for the government to say at a given point, look, enough is enough. You guys have to pay more. Well, I think the government should do that. But if he were to eliminate preferential dollars for the middle class would be on the streets and creating barricades again, as they did in 2014. So it's not that easy. Once these policies are set in place, it's difficult, not impossible, for the government to change course. Yeah, Donna.
Thanks, Steve. And I also want to say that I think it's a good and valuable move to try to understand how the radical left governs once in power, if we expect that. Because, you know, I'm interested in the Bolivian case in particular. And if I were to take your story, the nature of the opposition leads to a kind of, in the Venezuelan case, a kind of a political pragmatism that leads to a mixture of bad policies and some useful, valuable social policies. But that are ultimately, maybe those social policies, I would say, are probably going to be rendered unsustainable given the current macroeconomic crisis. Mm-hmm. So, well-intentioned, certainly, but sustainability in terms of not just their institutionalization within Venezuelan society, but in terms of the fiscal basis of the state itself. Taking that to Bolivia, I'm wondering if this travels, right? On one hand, you could say that after Evo first takes office in 2006, you have a period, so that you can fill me in on the exact years here, where, you know, you have that Media Luna opposition in Santa Cruz, Tarija, that the Hayes guts, and they want him out, and they want sovereign control over their resources, not sending it up to the Valles and Altiplano. Maybe you would code that as a weaker, disloyal opposition. I don't know if it's less loyal or if it's less, you know, filled with capacity, but certainly some preconditions there for some political expediency or some political pragmatism. But yet, Evo is willing to work within the state to execute his leftist agenda, right? And he's working broadly within the constraints of orthodox economic theory, or at least a viable heterodox version that looks more like Keynesianism than like 21st century socialism. And here they sit today, I think, and we all agree, much better macroeconomic foothold.
Right.
So I'm just inviting you to hopefully the beginning of a longer conversation about how you see this Venezuela story traveling to places like Bolivia.
Yeah, I agree that the Bolivia case involves much more institutional constraints than the Venezuelan case. But keep in mind that during that period, firstly, in retrospect, the opposition didn't stand a chance in the world, unlike Venezuela. In Venezuela, during the general strike, it looked like Chavez was going to be overthrown. I mean, oil production, if the Minister of Oil, who was Ali Rodriguez, he was president of PDVSA. If he had announced that oil production went down to zero, I would have said, well, you're exaggerating. But he gave us specific number of barrels. It was like 240 barrels. And when he said that, I said, it's all over for Chavez. So that it's true, but at the time in Bolivia, it looked like it was a pretty threatening situation. But keep in mind, Don, that, Morales worked within institutional frameworks, but the opposition didn't see things that way. And when he took advantage of the fact that the opposition delegates to the Constituent Assembly walked out in order to pass the Constitution, because the Morales people were saying that we just need a plain, simple majority. And the opposition was saying you need two-thirds, I think it was. So the Morales people must compromise and accept, and in that case accepted the opposition's demand, but then took advantage of a situation in which they only had a majority. They had a simple majority, but they took advantage of the situation of the mistake that the opposition delegates committed in order to, you could say, railroad through the Constitution. So these things, I think, are relative. But I do believe that after 2009, when Morales was elected with 64% and gained a majority, a two-thirds majority in both chambers, I think that was a moment, that was an opportunity, that was a window of opportunities for Morales to have perhaps done more than what he did with regard to these three objectives that I referred to.
I guess what I'm wondering, to put a finer point on it, is it about the nature of the opposition, or is it about the nature of the base, the political base that gave Morales the ability to certainly take shortcuts institutionally, extend the number of terms he can serve, et cetera, et cetera, but to build medical service provision within the state infrastructure, to build education provision within the state infrastructure, right? And is it open question, is it the nature of the opposition that allowed him to do that, or is it the nature of his base?
Well, obviously both. Obviously both. I would argue that the correlation of forces is really a key factor. That what some theorists refer to as subjective conditions, because they talk about objective conditions, namely the degree of economic development of the country, and subjective conditions. Subjective conditions are very hard to determine. I mean, it's much more elusive than objective conditions that can be quantified. But that correlation between those two factors that you mentioned is really key to understanding what the opportunities are, what the options are for the radicals in power. And certainly that was favorable to the radicals in 2009 when Morales won the elections by a landslide. Santiago.
Okay. I think I'm going to try to build on Don's questions too, because I'm also a little troubled with the idea of bringing this approach to studying other cases in the region. And if I understood Don's questions correctly too, I think because at the end of the day we get an image of, I would embrace with you the idea of complexity and seeing these governments as, complex coalitions of things. But take-home message I get from your talk is that it's coalitions of pragmatists and populists at the end of the day. And as the driving force of policymaking being the balance of power between government and opposition, little room for social basis, I think, that Don's trying to bring in, or for other actors for shaping policy. So I guess I was wondering, where are they in your story, right? So what besides the disloyal opposition shaped policy making? The other point is more conceptual, I think, as you move on with the project. I think I was slightly troubled at the beginning with the idea of the concept pragmatism, but you admitted it at first that it troubles you as well. And this is because at first it reads as both pragmatist policies and populists seem to be deviations from a purer version of something that we still don't know what it is, right? So they read as suboptimal policies from the point of view of something that I still don't, you know, I don't know what the pure version should be. I'm wondering if, you know, pragmatist politics shouldn't be phrased as, you know, elite accommodating policies or something like that. But that's a, you know, label choice.
But your question here is, what is the strategy, the original strategy?
Yeah, because this reads the implementation of these policies are just, a response to the threats of a disloyal opposition period that forces the government to deviate from sort of original pure path, right? And I still don't know what that path looks like, and I'm wondering, you know, how with that model I, you know, try to make sense of any other cases.
That's a good point.
The idea of the coalitions and why I was troubled initially is because, thinking about the case that Don brought to the table, the Bolivian case, it's far from a reduction to make it the case that it is composed of pragmatist and populist elements, and, you know, it's a much more complex, you know, monster, right? Occasionally pragmatist politics are implemented in response of, you know, the very same groups that form that coalition, not precisely the opposition, right? Think about the cooperative miners in Bolivia, you know, key veto group resisting heavier taxation. That's a major force deviating the Morales government from its very initial, you know, revolutionary goals. So I think, you know, they have to negotiate within a much more complex kind of set of forces.
Okay. Your first point, who are the pragmatists and who are the populists within the Chavista camp?
And can we reduce it to that?
What's that?
And can we reduce the coalition to those two elements?
Well, when I talked about pragmatism, I talked about those business people who entered into an alliance with the government, informal alliance with the government, and they can very clearly be identified. There's no question about it. I mean, I didn't do it because for lack of time. I did mention one, Fernandez Parueco, but Miguel Perez Abad, an Arab name, is the president of Fetra Industria. And that's pro-Chavez. He's pro-Chavez. In fact, he belongs to the PSUV and had political ambitions. So these people can be... And Alberto Cudemos, who received contracts all over the place and had been a candidate for president of FEDECAMRES twice on the basis of a conciliatory position towards the government. So those actors can definitely be identified. But not only them, but also... When I talked about pragmatism, I referred to the negotiations with FEDECAMRES. Now, FEDECAMRES is not Chavista, it's anti-Chavista. If anything, it's anti-Chavista. But that was part of the pragmatic approach, sitting down with the business sector and accepting concessions and modifications. With regard to the original strategy, that's a very good point. And I should have made the point that the original strategy was never that clear. I think that if you asked a Chavista, they'd say, I'm sure what the response would be, 21st century socialism is a work in progress, and that has its advantages and disadvantages. The advantage is that there's debate going on, and, you know, there's analysis of past mistakes, and so that's a healthy process. So I don't think that even the Chavistas would say that there's a blueprint there. But nevertheless, when you make concessions... And you, for instance, when you make deals, you know, I'll just give an example. of how the pragmatism represented a deviation. There was another alternative for the Chavistas. Rather than enter into this informal alliance or tacit alliance with the business sector, and that is that they could have just ignored the business class in general and not make distinctions at all, with the argument, and a valid argument, a cogent argument, that when you start making distinctions, that leads to corruption. That leads to a murky kind of situation in which, you know, perhaps Chavistas who are well-meaning and committed become corrupt as a result of that that interaction. So that was an alternative that, for the most part, was rejected. And your point about negotiations, yeah, that is what politics is all about. In the case of Bolivia, it's not only negotiations with the elite, it's negotiations, in this case, with the cooperatives, the cooperative miners, who certainly don't represent the elite. But it's the same point that I'm trying to make, is that if the government is doing something that is really a deviation from an original path, then that could present problems further down the road. Rita?
Yeah. So I was curious about bureaucracy and the problems with it. So you identified corruption and the problems with bureaucracy as one of the kind of limits of the government and where it hasn't advanced as much as hope. And I want to hear your thoughts about why you think that is. Because we've seen the problems with both the old existing state and then the new institutions that were built to bypass the state. And so what would you say were
the
main factors explaining the lack of advancement from the part of the government?
The lack of?
Advancement. Oh. Or, what's the word? Like progress.
Yeah.
In terms of fighting corruption or in terms of, I guess, addressing the bureaucracy and the inefficiencies in the bureaucracy.
Right. Right. With regard to the bureaucracy, just again to put a face on things, the fact that the internal elections of the PSUV, so the PSUV's credit, they have a system, or they have been pretty consistent in calling primaries to elect, in some cases, party leadership. And in almost all cases, nominating candidates in elections. You compare that with the opposition. The opposition has had a very poor track record, even though the Constitution obliges parties to call those internal elections. But on the other hand, Chavez at one point insisted that elected Chavistas cannot get involved, should not get involved in those processes. That the internal elections should not provide any pre-candidate, that's the term that's used in Venezuela, with material advantages or any other types of advantages. And that furthermore, the different pre-candidates should engage in debate. That was what Chavez proposed in 2009, if I remember correctly. That's not happening now at all. In these last internal elections for the leadership of the PSUV, there was a big turnout, but you didn't have internal debate. I didn't see it. And what I saw, at least in my state of Anzoátegui, the governor and his people at the municipal level got heavily involved in those elections. So that's what I mean about a problem with regard to bureaucracy that, in an advantageous kind of situation, the government can try to, for instance, establish rules. I mean, rules with regard to internal elections. Rules that say, no, elected officials cannot do anything in favor of any candidate. I mean, that could be a policy that could be set in a situation which is advantageous to the government. With regard to corruption, I don't really know what to say. Corruption is, some people say that corruption is endemic. In Venezuela, it certainly goes way back. There's a book by Leslie Gates, very interesting book, that states that it wasn't the corruption that got Chavez elected, it was the perception that the business class was was responsible to a large extent, along with the politicians, for the corruption. And that was what people got people set against Fede Cambadas, who opposed Chavez's election in 1998. So election is longstanding. But, you know, one factor is that, you know, when Chavez took over, he didn't clean out the bureaucracy. The Chavistas who got elected at the state level, the municipal election level, the same old people stayed in their positions, with a lot of exceptions, of course. Some new people came in. But so it wasn't, perhaps it might have been easier in a different kind of situation, which isn't feasible in a transition, a gradual transition in favor of structural change. It's not feasible to fire everybody in public office. It just can't happen that way. But the downside is that it's much harder if there is the intention to wipe out corruption. Your people who, let's say, in the best of cases, are idealistic, they get into those positions, and with interaction of people who have been doing things the old way for a long time, they're going to get corrupt as well. So that might be a factor that explains the corruption.
I believe we're out of time.
Okay.
But if you join me in thanking our speaker, it's been very, very... If any of you wants to continue the conversation, I'm sure Steve...
By all means. Where does that go?
I believe it will end up on the website.
Oh, really?
But I'll let you know.
Well, let me know.
Yeah, so I'll be... hold on. I'm still recording, so let me...